To add to our difficulties, we had an even bigger departure to contemplate. After 9 years as the moderator of The View, Meredith had decided to accept a dazzling offer of much more money from NBC to replace Katie Couric on The Today Show. I talked with Meredith about the offer. The View had brought her fame, and we were proud of that, but we could not match NBC's salary. I was and am very fond of Meredith, and this, I agreed, was an opportunity she couldn't possibly turn down. With tears and cheers, we said goodbye to Meredith in June 2006. Now we would not only be losing Star, but Meredith as well. We needed a big, new, bold attraction. That's when Rosie O'Donnell entered the picture. I had been an admirer of Rosie for years. I had often appeared on her own very popular television show, and had even substituted for her when she was ill. Rosie had left that show in 2002, she said, to spend more time with her life partner Kelly and their growing family, which by 2006 numbered 4 children. I was fond of both Rosie and Kelly. Rosie and Kelly had made a beautiful and touching documentary of a cruise for gay families that they had arranged and been on. On March 28, 2006, I went to see the premiere screening of the documentary. It made me laugh and cry. I knew that Rosie had spent most of the past 4 years, since she had left her own program, painting pictures. I even own one of the paintings. By now, with this documentary, it seemed that Rosie might be returning to public life. Could it be, I wondered that night, that Rosie might agree to become our new moderator? So I asked her, then and there, and she said yes. The next day, I told Bill. He, too, thought it was a great idea. I called Rosie to make sure she hadn't changed her mind. She hadn't. The ABC executives were a bit hesitant initially. Since Rosie had left television, she had been in a nasty legal dispute with the publishers of a magazine that bore her name, had produced a Broadway show, starring Boy George, that was a flop and didn't exactly add to her reputation, and most important, had revealed to all that she was a lesbian, something she had not publicly discussed during her own show. The network at first was afraid that Rosie might be too volatile a personality and too controversial. But I vouched for her and told them that I thought she had mellowed with the years. Also, I thought times had changed, and gays and lesbians were pretty much accepted all over the country. After we put Rosie in touch with the heads of the network, they, too, agreed that it would be a great coup to have her on The View. Rosie would start on the show in the fall, agreeing to sign for only 1 year. I had nothing to do with the contractual arrangements, which turned out later on to be a blessing. Of course, we told Star, who, I point out again, already knew that her contract was not going to be renewed. The trouble was that there was very bad blood between Star and Rosie. Rosie had from time to time been a guest on The View, and she and Star had tangled on a variety of issues both on and off the air. When Rosie was interviewed on other programs before she began on The View, she had accused Star of being dishonest about her weight loss. As a guest on The View, Rosie had said to her face, "It's like twinkle, twinkle, shrinking Star." Had Star continued to be on the program, we probably would not have reached out to Rosie, but because Star was not going to remain on The View, our decision about Rosie was not going to affect Star's departure one way or another. We reassured Star once more that we would never say that the network had dismissed her. I reiterated that she could give any reason she wanted for leaving and could also choose the date to depart the program. We would dedicate a full-hour retrospective tribute to her and give her a farewell party on the air. Again, Star agreed to this. Star told us she wanted to leave after Meredith and chose Thursday, June 29th to make her own announcement. But on Tuesday, June 27th, while we were live on the air, Star suddenly grasped my hand and Joy's and said that after much prayer and counsel, she had decided to leave the program. Her announcement took us totally by surprise. Thinking she had just decided to move up her announcement date, I asked the audience to rise and give her a standing ovation. But as it turned out, to our astonishment, Starr had, over the previous weekend, given an interview to People magazine. In the magazine, which was about to hit the newsstands, she announced that she had been fired. It was not the drop in her popularity among viewers that had caused her dismissal, Starr insisted, but the new direction the show wanted to take, that is, Rosie. She said that unlike the rest of us, that is, Bill, and especially me, she was going to tell the truth. Here, Bill and I were risking our own reputations for honesty to protect her. Instead, she was damaging our credibility. We were very hurt. The network immediately held a crisis meeting with us to decide what to do. I felt that Starr should continue until the day she was due to leave. I hate confrontation and thought that if she continued, it might make matters less explosive. Bill felt strongly that Starr now could not be trusted. The network agreed. Starr was asked not to return. That was almost 2 years ago. Starr seemed to have had a difficult time finding another job. I still feel it might have been easier for her to find a new position if she had left the program in the graceful way we had suggested. But in August 2007, she debuted on Court TV, hosting her own program. Starr has said that she had a long time to think. Before the new program began, she admitted that she had indeed undergone a gastric bypass. I give her great credit. She looks very different now than she did on The View. Among other changes, she wears glasses. But the intelligence and the charm are still there. Unfortunately, Starr's program only lasted 6 months, but I realized how much I missed her. Not just on the air, where she had made a huge contribution to the success of The View, but off. I wrote a note to her in the fall of 2007 and asked if we could meet. We did, for breakfast. Starr's schedule does not permit her time for lunch, and we embraced each other with sincere warmth. We did not attempt to replace Starr on The View. We thought one new member of the cast was enough for the season, but also there was no one we could think of who had the qualities Starr had originally brought to the program. Instead, Bill arranged for a variety of guest co-hosts, many of them African-Americans. Rosie O'Donnell began co-hosting The View on September 5th, 2006. She introduced a whole new and challenging chapter of the program. How to describe it? It was like a roller coaster ride or a bumpy trip on a fast-moving bus. Rosie had originally said she wanted to ride the bus, not drive it, but this backseat role was simply not in her nature. Rosie is a big talent, funny, smart, opinionated, passionate, and controlling. Almost from her first weeks, Rosie had difficulty accepting Bill as the producer in charge of the program. She challenged his decisions. She didn't want features on beauty or fashion or medical subjects, all of which had been popular on the show. In the months that followed, they had almost no relationship. At one point, Bill confided in me that he was not sure he wanted to continue on the program. Rosie also had difficulty with Mark Gentile and some of the crew, the floor managers, the stagehands, and the audio engineers. There was so much bad feeling that when The View had its annual Christmas party, many of the staff refused to attend until they learned that Rosie wouldn't be able to come. These situations troubled me, but I hoped that in time they would clear up. Still, Rosie was a professional. She gave her heart to the program, and sometimes it was difficult for her. I understood that. From the beginning, Rosie openly discussed her emotional problems. She was on medication, she told us. She suffered from depression and often felt rage. Her mother had died when Rosie was 4 days away from her 11th birthday. The loss was always with her. She repeatedly said she missed the love and approval of a mother. Sometimes, she said, she saw me in that role. That was fine with me. I often felt maternal toward Rosie. We did a special hour on depression with Rosie discussing her own problems. At one point, she hung upside down in a kind of harness to show what she did at home to relieve her depression. This was an important television program. It not only provided information to our viewers, but her candor helped us understand Rosie's emotional swings. In the early weeks of the program, we were all rather anxious about what kind of a mood Rosie would be in when she entered the dressing room. One day she would be upbeat and smiling, the next day dark and subdued. Gradually, we learned to go with the flow, as they say, and not take too seriously or personally her morning disposition. The View had been a great success for years, including the season before Rosie joined the program. But she took it to new heights with her great humor and energy. She was wonderful with children and treated us to charming stories about her own kids. She also loved Broadway, and we booked as many Broadway stars as we could. On her birthday, Rosie asked to have a whole program of musical numbers performed by the casts of the Broadway shows she liked the most. We did so in tribute to her. Rosie has probably sold more tickets to Broadway shows than any advertisements could have. The premise of The View is that of a team working together. But for Rosie, it was more like Diana Ross and the Supremes, as little by little she took over. Still, she was such a talent that we lived with it. All was pretty steady until the Donald Trump feud took place over the Christmas holidays. The View was about to go on a holiday hiatus. I left the program a week before the vacation began to join my friend, the columnist Cindy Adams, on Judge Judy's yacht. While I was gone, Rosie attacked Trump on the air, calling him a snake oil salesman, making fun of his hairstyle, and saying, among other things, that he had declared bankruptcy. I knew that was incorrect because in the past I had interviewed Trump on the subject. Trump threatened to sue ABC, The View, Rosie, and me. From my boat in the Caribbean, I joined Bill in a conference call to Trump. He was furious. Bill and I told him we would clear up the issue of the bankruptcy. That was all we said, and we assumed that would be the end of it. But it wasn't. Within a half hour, Trump was talking to everyone. There wasn't a radio or TV show that he didn't go on, hurling the most personal insults against Rosie. Trump had been my friend for many years. He often appeared on The View, and I had attended his wedding to the beautiful Melania. So I tried to make peace. ABC insisted that we make clear that he had not declared bankruptcy. I returned to The View a week before Rosie finished her vacation, and with the assistance of ABC's legal department, Rosie's own lawyer, and her brother, who advises her, we drafted a statement. I went on the air and said very clearly that Trump had not been bankrupt. End of possible lawsuit. I then criticized Trump for his insulting remarks about Rosie and did what I thought was a very strong defense of her. I said how valuable she was to the program and how much the viewers and the critics loved her. Trump then attacked me. Things got worse. When Rosie finally returned to The View, to my amazement, she angrily berated me in the dressing room for not defending her enough. She said I had told Donald Trump during the conference call from the yacht that I didn't want her on the program. Bill and I insisted that I never said any such thing. She refused to believe us. The funny thing is that even though her accusations were totally wrong and extremely upsetting, I could somehow understand her turmoil. Perhaps she thought of me as the mother who had once more abandoned her. How did I get caught in the middle of a mess I'd originally had no part in? Yet, though it was a mess to me, the viewers loved the feud and the ratings soared. Things got calmer. Rosie and I returned to our earlier friendly state. And the viewers, who now never knew what to expect from the outspoken Rosie, tuned in each day to see what she would do or say. ABC's executives were happy with Rosie, so along with the network, I said to myself, it is a new View. What is good for the View is good for me. But if the result of the Trump feud was higher ratings, it also meant that now Rosie seemed to be enjoying feuds. She had a little feud with Kelly Ripa, another with Paula Abdul and her show American Idol, and a bigger one with Bill O'Reilly, who began to call on his own program for her to be fired. She also, almost daily, attacked President Bush and condemned the invasion of Iraq. Elizabeth Hasselbeck, who supported Bush, reacted strongly, and she and Rosie faced off time and again on the air, but it never became personal. However, as the weeks rolled on, the program became more and more political, and Rosie became more and more controversial. We were the talk of the industry. Like her or hate her, you could not stop watching Rosie. The network, though, was beginning to be uncomfortable. Even so, in the spring of 2007, they began to negotiate with Rosie for the next season. I deliberately had nothing to do with the negotiations. I didn't want another Star Jones experience where the network made the decision and I took the blame. By now, I understood Rosie better and hoped she would come back. However, ABC Daytime and Rosie's representatives came to an impasse, and in April 2007, Rosie announced that she would not be returning to The View. I was disappointed. But unlike Star's departure, this announcement was all very amicable. Rosie said she would stay on the program until the end of June. We went on with business as usual. Then came Wednesday, May 23rd. Joy said on the air that she thought George Bush should be impeached. Elizabeth defended Bush, and the beginning arguments were relatively civil, until Rosie jumped in. For several weeks, Rosie had been expressing the thought that by invading Iraq, we Americans could also be considered terrorists. Some people, especially Bush supporters, took this to mean that she had said our troops were terrorists. Rosie never meant that. But as various viewers and critics began accusing her of that, she demanded that day that Elizabeth, who she felt represented the conservative point of view, defend her against these accusations. It was similar to her demanding that I defend her against the remarks she had made about Donald Trump. Elizabeth responded by saying Rosie should defend her own remarks. Tempers became inflamed. There was name-calling and shouting. The accusations back and forth grew stronger. It was horrendous to watch. I know I was not on the program that day, but I was at home watching. I called the control room and told them to go to commercial. It didn't happen. The shouting match went on. Bill Getty later said if he had gone to commercial while Rosie was still talking, she might very well have walked off the set, and that would have been worse. Finally, thank heaven, we did go to commercial. And when we came back, there was a guest, Alicia Silverstone, to be interviewed, and the program went back to normal. But great harm had been done. That night, every news program carried the screaming match, as did all the morning news programs. Everyone loved this catfight of all catfights. Elizabeth was in despair. She never expected such a confrontation. Rosie, I am sure, must also have been miserable. The afternoon of the outburst, Rosie announced that since the next day, Thursday, was Kelly's 40th birthday, it really was, she would be taking the day off. I moderated the Thursday show and opened the program by saying, "Auntie Barbara is back, there is peace in the kingdom." But as luck, or irony, would have it, President Bush gave a press conference on immigration at 11 a.m., and our program was not seen in most of the country. My attempt at peace and humor went unnoticed. We were about to go off on the long Memorial Day weekend and had prepared our Friday and Monday shows. If I write another book, remembering that the Trump business also happened during a Christmas week holiday, I may title it My Holiday Misadventures. Holiday or not, the network and I waited anxiously to hear whether Rosie was coming back to the program to finish her last 3 weeks. Finally, the word came. Rosie emailed me that she would not be coming back to The View. She gave no reason for leaving the program. What a way to end her year with us. ABC put out a brief statement on its website. Brian Franz, the president of ABC Daytime, thanked her for her tremendous contribution to The View. I wrote in part that I had brought Rosie to the show, and she contributed to one of our most exciting and successful years. Rosie's press representative issued a statement from Rosie that said she was extremely grateful and added, "It has been an amazing year and I love all three women." So there it was. I felt exhausted and sad. I emailed Rosie and said so. "I am very sorry that you decided not to come back, but you must have felt it best for you and your family. I want you to know that my admiration and affection for you will remain unchanged. I meant it. In the fall of 2007, however, I almost changed my mind when Rosie published a book called Celebrity Detox. She sent me an advance copy with a handwritten note proclaiming, "Here's my book. I hope you like it. Remember, Barbara Walters, I love you for real." When I read the note, I smiled, but when I read her book, I wanted to cry. Rosie once more called me a liar who betrayed her when it came to the Donald Trump feud. Will she ever get over him? Other harsh and insulting accusations, some logical, some off the wall, filled page after page. Mixed up in the criticisms were protestations of love. It was such a seesaw of emotions that I didn't know how to answer her. I am not a Pollyanna, but I truly believe that Rosie did not intend to hurt me. She herself must have come to regret what she'd written because she canceled most of her television interviews promoting the book. She also sent me a series of long, tender emails. I was touched by them and did finally respond. I can't be mad at Rosie for long. Rosie is at heart a remarkable and loving woman. She has admirable personal values, and if she sometimes overreacts, it is out of her misplaced rage, hurt, and passionate convictions. However, I admit that along with the sadness I felt when Rosie left The View, I also acknowledge some relief. The roller coaster ride was over. We could take a deep breath and start a new chapter of The View. But now came the question of where we would possibly find another high-profile, smart, funny, and savvy TV person. Brainstorm, Whoopi Goldberg. Whoopi had appeared on The View something like 20 times over the years. Whenever we needed a special guest, we called on Whoopi. Now she was living in New York and doing an early morning radio show. Could she, would she also do The View? She could. She would. Our 11th season began on September 4th, 2007, the day after Labor Day. The audience went wild when Whoopi walked on stage. She sat down next to Joy and became a joy all to herself. Whoopi has such wisdom along with her humor. She is mellow and at the same time contributes to the edginess the program needs. We had made the perfect choice. The following week, we announced that we were adding another permanent member to the cast. There would be no more different co-hosts each day. Sherry Shepherd, a stand-up comedian, was becoming a favorite on our program. Like Whoopi, she had appeared on The View many times. She is divorced with a little boy, good-natured, down-to-earth, and naturally funny. With the two new additions to our panel, once more our ratings have soared. Joy, who has been on The View since day one, continues to add her own special brand of intelligence and humor. And Elizabeth is not only a lovely person off camera and on, but she more than holds her own, even when the whole panel might disagree with her. Believe me, it ain't easy, but it works. Indeed, almost a dozen years since The View made its debut, the program is more successful than ever. Bill and I wanted The View to return to its roots as the program you could sit back and watch while sipping your second cup of coffee and hear different opinions on different subjects from different women. Most of all, we wanted everyone to just have a really good time. We are. Exit. The View was a big part of my life, but not the biggest. What I was really known for was my work on 2020. ABC's News Magazine. But I was about to change all that. On Monday, January 26th, 2004, after 25 years on 2020, I made the announcement that I was leaving the program. My contract still had 2.5 years to go, and it was assumed that when it ended, I would renew it for another 5 years. I left totally voluntarily. I had told no one of my decision except David Weston, president of ABC News, and Bill Carter, the leading television reporter of the New York Times. As planned, Bill Carter broke the story in his paper. This is how he put it. After conducting some of the most memorable television interviews of the last quarter century for the ABC News Magazine 2020, Barbara Walters has decided to leave as co-anchor of the program. Ms. Walters has informed the president of ABC News, David Weston, that she will step down from 2020 in September and plans to scale back her workload to 5 or 6 news specials each year, including her highly rated Oscar night interviews in addition to her regular appearances on The View, the ABC show she created. ABC News is expected to announce her departure from 2020 today. It was a big story in the television industry. Almost no one expected it. How to explain? Well, shortly after, for the same paper, the reporter Virginia Heffernan wrote what she called my exit interview. Here is part of that article. Heffernan, you've been at 2020 for 25 years. Why are you leaving now? Walters, I wanted to leave at the top. I had a sensational year, including the second interview with Martha Stewart. News magazines in general are somewhat in jeopardy. I didn't want anyone to say she was forced out, she had to leave. Heffernan, but have you gotten tired of television news? Walters, it's changing. For example, we're going to hear that a woman has had a love affair with a frog. The producers are going to come to me and say, Barbara, this woman had a love affair with a frog. Diane Sawyer already has the woman lined up. Do you want to do the frog? And I'll say, okay, but only if I can get the frog and his mother. And they'll say, but the frog wants an hour. And before you do the frog is going to do Oprah, okay? That about summed it up. But it wasn't only about the competition from Diane or Oprah or any one person. It was more about the changing nature of the news magazines. The hard news stories we used to report on were few and far between, except on CBS's stalwart 60 Minutes. But that news magazine catered to an older audience. 2020 was after the young, the 18 to 49-year-olds. That was the age group advertisers sought out. So increasingly, we were after more celebrities, especially those with problems. More murderers, and more frogs. And it seemed that every celebrity, every murderer, every frog had a lawyer or a press agent all interviewing the interviewer to determine where they could get the most airings for their client, what kind of questions would be asked, and how much promotion and advertising would be guaranteed. The interviewer had to audition to land the interview. The press agents for the celebrities were the worst, with endless demands and restrictions. You can't ask this. You can't talk about that. It wasn't much fun anymore for me, and it certainly wasn't prestigious. I was plenty busy. Between 2002 and 2004, I interviewed around 100 people for 2020, from Mariah Carey to Al Gore, and after a 25-year wait, a new interview with Fidel Castro. But interviews with heads of state, even someone as hard to land as Castro, were becoming less appealing to news magazines. Celebrities with problems were becoming less appealing to me. It wasn't just that. Everybody in my business works hard. Well, almost everybody. But at that point, I was swamped. I was not only fully involved with 2020 and The View, which by then, 7 years since its debut, was running full steam. I was also doing a minimum of 3 1-hour primetime specials a year. On an average day, I would get into my 2020 office at 12:30, having just finished appearing on The View in a different building. I would go to the ABC cafeteria to pick up a salad and eat at my desk. When I came back to my office, there was a lineup of producers waiting to discuss whatever story they were doing with me. There was also my super conscientious booker, Katie Thompson, standing with a list of future guests. Then there was David Sloan, the executive producer of 2020, with another list. If I was doing a special, Bill Getty would be on the phone, anxious to discuss which interviews we should try to get that would not conflict with 2020. All this I could handle, and would have continued to, were it not for the big get and the pressure to be the first to secure an interview with whoever was making news, whoever was involved in a scandal, whoever was appearing in the newest film, whoever was accused of murdering his or her parents or wife or lover. In my last 2 years on 2020, getting the gets had gotten out of control. I was not only competing with the news magazines on the other networks, Dateline, 48 Hours, 60 Minutes, and its spinoff, 60 Minutes 2, But with the new crop of nightly entertainment interview programs like Entertainment Tonight and Access Hollywood and the like. And finally, I was competing right inside my own network. A little history. ABC was the only network to have two competing women on two nighttime news magazines, Diane Sawyer and me. Rune Arledge had orchestrated that. If there was a big star on another network, Rune could not rest until he secured that star for ABC. It was the reason ABC had such a strong news lineup. For example, Rune had offered Dan Rather an anchor job at ABC while Walter Cronkite was still doing the evening news at CBS. It was CBS's determination to keep Dan that made that network take Walter off the program in 1981, before he later said he truly wanted to leave. Walter had many good years left as an effective anchor, but CBS more or less said bye-bye, and Dan took over the news program. So Rune not only made waves at ABC, he also created choppy waters at other networks. In 1989, Rune had lured Diane away from CBS, where she had been appearing very successfully on 60 Minutes. He convinced her that whereas on 60 Minutes she was one of an ensemble, at ABC, she would have her own magazine program and could choose to do any story she wanted. Rune then created a new magazine program on Thursday nights at 10 p.m. called Primetime Live. Diane's partner was the brash former White House correspondent Sam Donaldson. They were described as a sort of Beauty and the Beast pairing, the cool, lovely Diane and the boisterous and irreverent Sam. But it was a pairing that didn't click. Still, ABC Now had an hour news magazine at 10 p.m. on Thursday nights and another, 2020, on Friday nights, also at 10 p.m. Eventually, Charlie Gibson replaced Sam as Diane's partner. By this time, primetime was successful, and after a certain point, we at 2020 felt we were competing as much with primetime as we were with news magazines on other networks. Then in 1999, Diane, a terrific reporter and so hardworking, took on another formidable assignment as the co-anchor with Charlie Gibson of ABC's morning program, Good Morning America. That program was locked in a ferocious battle with its NBC counterpart, my old stomping ground, The Today Show. The morning shows were huge moneymakers, much more than the news magazines, because they had much more commercial time to sell, being on 5 days a week. It was therefore all the more important that Diane snag the big get. We at 2020 were suddenly competing not just with primetime, but with GMA as well, and we hated the whole idea. Diane and I struggled to figure out what to do, especially when we were competing for the same newsmaker or celebrity for our respective news magazines. We each had a booker to help pave the way with a potential guest's lawyers, press agents, and other handlers. Then we would come in for the last round of phone calls or meetings. Our bookers were notoriously competitive. Diane and I were more polite. We would say something like this to the press agents: I hope you will do the interview with me. If not, I hope you will do it with my colleague, Barbara or Diane, whatever the case might be. We were out for the kill ourselves, but if we didn't get the interview, we didn't want one of the other networks to get it. We were both so successful on our news magazines that, although most people don't remember this, in September 1998, the year before Diane started to appear on GMA, ABC put us on as co-hosts on a Sunday night edition of 2020. The network figured if one of us was good, two would be better. But although we enjoyed working together instead of competing, our hearts weren't in it. We were keeping our best stories for our own programs. The Sunday program died within a year. It was also decided that instead of primetime and 2020 being two separate news magazines, they would merge into two nights of the more successful 2020. The staffs would also merge, but Diane and I would each still anchor on our own night. It was an awful time. The producers couldn't figure out which pieces should go on which nights, and in spite of having the same name, the programs were still competing. We hadn't taken lemons and made lemonade, we'd taken lemonade and made lemons. The dual 2020s lasted just 2 years. When David Weston took over from Roone as president of the news division, we went back to two separate shows, Primetime and 2020. By that time, Hugh Downs had retired from 2020 to live in Arizona. When Hugh left, I had a new partner, John Miller. John was ABC's crack investigative reporter. He also, among all of us, was the only person to have interviewed Osama bin Laden. I adored John. He was so smart and funny. But our partnership was short-lived. John gave up the fame and money of broadcasting to move to Los Angeles and join the LAPD's chief, William Bratton, as bureau chief for the Counterterrorism and Criminal Intelligence Bureau. Currently, John is assistant director of public affairs for the FBI in Washington. After John left, I was fortunate to have another John, John Stossel, as my new partner. John and I had worked together for so many years on 2020 that it was an easy transition. But usually neither John nor Charlie, Diane's partner on both Primetime and GMA, went after the gets. Those were left more often to Diane and me. There was one more wrinkle. Roone, in his ever-expanding desire to hire all the best talent, had persuaded Connie Chung to leave CBS, where she had been paired with Dan Rather on the evening news. Their duet in 1993 was as big a failure as the combination of Harry Reasoner and me years before. Roone promised Connie an anchor job, which put her in the position of competing with not one, but two other female anchors, Diane and me. I was and am very fond of Connie, and it couldn't have been easy for her. Whenever she wanted to go after a get, she was told that Diane or I had first dibs. Connie's big coup was the first interview with Gary Condit, the congressman alleged to have been involved in the disappearance and presumed murder of Chandra Levy, an intern in Washington. But she had to struggle to get any other important interviews, and she was understandably unhappy. Soon after her Condit piece, CNN offered her a job. David Weston, with great relief, I think, released her from her ABC contract. So Connie left, but that didn't really help the situation between GMA, Primetime, and 2020. Finally, in desperation, Weston assigned a conscientious arbitrator named Kerry Smith to make the choice as to who should go after which interview. It was a thankless job for her, and a particularly difficult setup for me. Kerry Smith's theory was that whoever seemed to have been working on the story earlier should be the one to whom it would be assigned. Diane not only had her bookers on Primetime, but another whole set of bookers on Good Morning America. They booked both short-term and long-term. I also knew that in the early morning competition, it was more important for the daily GMA to score a big get than for the weekly 2020. I was running as fast as I could, but it seemed to me it was an uneven playing field. Moreover, Diane could offer a guest a package of two or three appearances on GMA, as well as a more lengthy appearance on Primetime. I didn't have that option. To make it even more difficult, the Today Show was doing the same thing. The competition between the two programs was fierce. And my lighthearted daytime program, The View, was just not in the league of GMA, Today, or the other news magazines. Today, when Diane and I no longer compete, we have a relationship of good humor and affection. I mean that sincerely. Diane is a wonderful reporter, the best. Back then, however, we often found ourselves in that hated competition, and as much as we wanted, there seemed to be nothing we could do about it. We never criticized each other in public or in print, but the conflict was well known inside ABC. So that was more or less how things stood in 2003. I complained to Jackie about the show almost every time I talked with her. "Why don't you leave, Mom?" she would say. "You've been doing that program for 25 years. What else do you have to prove? Leave now while you still feel good about it." Maybe she was right, I thought. I also sought the advice of Monica Caulfield, my trusted assistant. She, perhaps more than anyone, knew what my schedule was like. I remember her saying, "It's a great big world out there, and it will set you free." Still, I wasn't sure. That summer, I walked the beach with two wise and close couples, Elizabeth and Felix Rowatin and Louise and Henry Grunwald, and discussed over and over again my feelings about wanting to give up 2020. Felix had been the U.S. ambassador to France. Henry had been, for years, the editor-in-chief of Time Incorporated. Both men knew what it was like to leave extremely important and influential positions. Their wives were also very informed and understanding. I could fully explore my conflicted feelings with the four of them. The View, then, was like dessert, fun and not hard to do. The specials took time but were in general also fun. Working on 2020, on the other hand, seemed debilitating and exhausting. But would I miss it? Would I miss the rare interview with the president or head of state? Would I, now that I was not on a major news program, miss being seated at some black tie dinner next to a visiting prime minister? To that, I said no. It is usually much more fun not to be seated next to a prime minister, especially when he or she speaks no English, but I might not be invited to the party. As an agent I knew said of one of his clients who had retired, "I love you, and I will miss you." Moreover, and more important, I realized that I was ending the major part of my career and might have trouble filling my days. Oh well, I told myself, I can finally learn Spanish, go to museums, travel, and stay in a foreign country for more than one day. I kept walking the beach until I was sure. Then in the fall of 2003, David Weston called and asked if he could come to my office and talk. He wanted to tell me of a new plan to make the booking competition between Diane and me less difficult. He was as unhappy with the situation as I was. But by then, I had made up my mind. Before he could describe his plan, I stopped him. "No need to tell me," I said. "Don't be upset, but I'm leaving 2020. He was stunned, and I realize now that I never did hear what his plan was. But I did tell him my plan and my reasons. I asked him to please keep my decision a secret from everyone until I had decided how and when to announce it. I asked him not to tell even Michael Eisner. This was a big thing to ask, but David understood. I think the world of David Weston. He is a man of his word, and his word was all I needed. Then he said, "Whatever you want to do, I just can't afford to lose you. You are an icon." Nice to hear, I thought, but there are a lot of icons these days. "You will stay in news. We will work something out." And we did. As I had no agent, I asked a brilliant entertainment lawyer, Alan Grubman, to represent me and meet with David to discuss my future at ABC News. True to his word, Weston offered me a new long-term contract and asked if I would agree to do 4 to 5 primetime specials a year. These would include the 2 very popular hours I had been doing for so many years, 10 Most Fascinating People and the Academy Awards special. The others would be mutually agreed to. As it has turned out, in the years since I left 2020, I have also done 3 extremely highly rated and controversial non-celebrity specials. 1 on transgender children who consider themselves born into the wrong bodies, and 2 others, 1 on the question of the existence of heaven, and the other on the new science of longevity, leading to the search to live beyond 100. I am planning to do that myself. Where are my vitamins? David also asked me to continue to contribute commentary when a president, head of state, or important celebrity whom I'd interviewed died. From time to time, he said, I might also be asked to do an interview for a special if it was deemed very important. This would be the case for my interviews in France with the doctor of the woman who had the first face transplant after her dog mauled her, and the hour with Terry Irwin in Australia. I also contributed to the coverage of the funerals of President Ronald Reagan and Gerald Ford. I agreed to continue to do this kind of reporting and signed the contract. Forget the language lessons, forget the museums, I would still have a full plate, but on the other hand, I would be out of the daily competition. What a great relief that has turned out to be. We decided that although I would make the announcement of my leaving 2020 a few months later, in January 2004, I would continue on the program until September, so that I could launch the person who would take my place. David Weston chose Elizabeth Vargas, a fine reporter. When January came, I called Bill Carter and said I wanted to speak to him confidentially. Bill had done quite a few stories on me in the past, including a 1992 New York Times Magazine cover story. I wanted to release my statement in the most dignified way, so I gave my news to him as an exclusive. The day before the article was to appear, David Weston told Michael Eisner and Jeffrey Schneider, the ABC News vice president who oversees communication. The next morning, Carter's column appeared on the front page of the New York Times business section. When I finally saw my words in print, I felt both scared and relieved. My 25 years on 2020, the mainstay of my career, were over. I had done the deed, and I was on to a new and uncharted course of my life. I thought my colleagues would not be surprised. They knew how heavy a workload I had and how I struggled over the gets. Certainly I thought my executive producer, David Sloan, knew. I would really miss working with David. He was my friend, as well as extremely talented at his job. But as it turned out, neither he nor anyone on the staff had any idea. As soon as I arrived in my office, I hastily called the staff together. Some were in tears, perhaps because they were also concerned about losing their jobs. David Sloan and I assured them this would not happen. Most just hugged me and asked that I do my last story or any future stories with them. I loved my producers. We had worked very closely together, preparing and editing. I was very hands-on. Some of them had worked only with me all these years on the program. I promised to keep my hand in and do stories for 2020 now and then. It was an extremely emotional meeting. That fall, ABC News presented a 2-hour retrospective special of my work called 25 on 2020. It was painstakingly produced by Martin Clancy, who had worked with me on so many interviews and reports for so many years. Martin chose highlights from each of the 25 years and each category of interview. There were heads of state, the politicians, the human interest stories, the murderers, alleged or convicted, the celebrities, the famous and the infamous. It was a list culled from hundreds of interviews that even surprised me. I was very proud of the program, which aired September 17, 2004. After I left 2020, the show underwent somewhat of a change. My departure made it even more difficult for the program to attract the big gets. The format often turned instead to theme programs, with one subject being investigated or analyzed for an hour. John Stossel did a whole series of programs looking at myths about things we fear but shouldn't. There were also hours on subjects like hate, lust, happiness, and greed. The program still ran important interviews, but less often with big stars or world leaders. Those super gets, more and more, went to Oprah or to Diane for Good Morning America. Even so, 2020 still continues and is an important and valuable program. Once I announced that I was leaving, I was deluged with requests for interviews and invitations to be honored by this or that organization. It was like reading my own obituary. I hadn't retired from television, but it looked as if I had. I turned down all the so-called honors and most of the interviews. I thought the exit interview I had done for the New York Times said it all. The interviews I did do were with Oprah, one for her magazine O, and one for her television program. As I have written, Oprah is one of the people I could interview again and again. Now the tables were turned, and she wanted to interview me. Not only did I feel I owed her these interviews because of our long-term relationship, I also felt, as I haven't told you before, that I owed her my life. Well, not exactly. This is what happened. In 1995, I was at a luncheon honoring top women in communications. The lunch was supposed to be over by 2 o'clock so we could all get back to work, but the event went long, and Oprah was forced to go overtime in her presentation to author Toni Morrison. It was close to 3 o'clock when I got back to my office, where I was startled to be greeted by my terrified assistants, in tears, by the then president and COO of ABC, Robert Iger, and by the police. Seems that while I was listening to Oprah, a freak windstorm had blown a beam off a construction site across the street from my office and sent it crashing through my windows. My desk, which was glass, was shattered by the beam, and my whole office was covered in shards. I don't want to think what would have happened if I'd been at my desk at the time. For my television interview with Oprah, her producers asked if my daughter would appear. Jackie, who almost always chose to stay out of the limelight, said yes. She actually has stage fright, so this appearance was an act of love. I laughed when Oprah asked Jackie how she felt about my leaving 2020. Jackie responded that she had wanted me to leave so I could have more time for myself. "But the bad thing is," she said, "she's going to call me all the time now." I especially wanted to do the interview for Oprah's magazine. I subscribe to O and always find many articles I want to read. Oprah flew to New York in August and came to my apartment to do the interview. Everyone in my home loved her. Chacha, Ikodel, and wonderful George. George Pineda, who had worked for Merv, became my treasured chief of staff a few years after my divorce. He handles many of my business affairs as well as taking care of almost every aspect of my life. Oprah was so warm and gracious. We all had our photographs taken with her, and later she signed them individually, placed them in silver frames, and sent them to us. We are true fans. She and I talked about a variety of things for the magazine, but what affected me the most is the last question and answer. I reprint it here. Oprah, what does being Barbara Walters mean? Me. I'm not sure. I realize how blessed I have been, but sometimes I still feel inadequate. I don't cook, I can't drive. Most of the time when I look back on what I've done, I think, did I do that? Why didn't I enjoy it more? Was I working too hard to see? As I said this, I looked up at Oprah and saw that she had tears in her eyes. I had touched a chord. Without any more words, we both knew what we had achieved and perhaps what we had given up. Most hardworking women would understand what we felt. One of those hardworking women is Connie Chung, who gave a lovely luncheon for me soon after I left 2020. Connie invited almost every female television journalist from New York and Washington. Most, I knew. There was also a whole new and younger group. During the toasts, I heard over and over how I had paved the way, opened the doors, and fought the wars for them. I felt proud and happy, and 100 years old. Then ABC gave an official party for me on September 22nd, 2 days before I was to leave 2020. I thought it would be a smallish affair with publicists and publishers invited because, after all, I was going to continue to do specials and would need to keep up my contacts. I decided, therefore, not to invite any of my own friends who were not in the business. I figured it would be a routine party with a lot of industry people and would bore them. I also told Jackie, who was living in Maine, not to come for it. "It's no big deal," I told her. The party was held from 6 to 8 p.m. in one of the cavernous floors of ABC's Times Square studio, where GMA originated every weekday morning. I didn't want to be the first to arrive, so I came shortly before 6:30 to find the entrance lined with dozens of paparazzi. Were they all there for me? Was anybody else coming? I entered to find the room jammed. People laughing, talking, greeting one another. There were people from every network, and many, it appeared, hadn't seen each other in years. David Weston, who had been so sensitive to my needs those last months, was at the door, greeting everyone. All of my colleagues, producers, editors, writers, on, were there. Must have been 100 of them. As well as all the ABC correspondents. Peter Jennings, now very warm and gracious, along with Diane Sawyer, Charlie Gibson, Robin Roberts, Elizabeth Vargas, and John Stossel, and all my colleagues from ABC News. Ted Koppel and Sam Donaldson, my old buddies from my earliest days at ABC, flew in from Washington and then flew back the same night. The then Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, was there, as were New York's Mayor Michael Bloomberg, Donald and Melania Trump, in happier days for the Trumps and me, and most touching to me, Christopher Reeve, who came in his specialized wheelchair with his wife Dana. And there was the mix of Geraldo Rivera, Bill O'Reilly, Roger Ailes, head of the Fox News Channel, Paul Azan, Connie Chung, Maury Povich, Judge Judy, Bryant Gumbel, Katie Couric, and of course, all the ladies from The View. Henry Kissinger, one of the rare guests not in the business, arrived to join the mix. Peter Jennings took the microphone and talked about some of the stories we had covered together over the years, starting with Sadat's historic trip to Jerusalem in 1977. Peter had been at ABC when I arrived there 30 years earlier. He now saw working with me in a happier light, and with his lovely wife Casey, was in great form that night. Who could ever have imagined that the following year, Peter would die of lung cancer? His death devastated all of us. Michael Eisner sent sentimental greetings via tape, and Sweeney, the very smart president of ABC, told of being a page at the company years earlier and how she had been told not to approach the talent, which was me. Fortunately, I had evidently been very friendly to her. Hey, you never know when the page will one day turn up as the president. Then some surprises. Dan Rather, who had just days before been excoriated by the White House and much of the press for a controversial and, it turned out, inaccurate news report on George W. Bush, braved the waiting line of paparazzi shouting questions at him. So did Martha Stewart, who had been convicted and would soon start her prison sentence. The fact that both Dan and Martha came meant a great deal to me. Everybody kissed me and toasted me. Do I sound like an awful jerk? Should this have meant so much? I'm not sure, but it did. I felt rather like Sally Field, who famously said upon accepting an Academy Award, "You like me. You really like me." When the reception broke up at about 9 p.m., late as no one seemed to want to leave, I once again walked past the long line of paparazzi. Cameras snapped, flashbulbs flashed. I laughed and posed. With me were David and Sherry Weston, Phyllis McGrady, and David Sloan. I invited all of them to the famous restaurant Le Cirque for a two-martini dinner. Finally, thoroughly sloshed, I went home with memories that warm me to this day. If I had second thoughts about leaving 2020, and sometimes in the wee small hours of the night I did, by morning, they were gone. Most of what I felt was relief. No more phone calls, letters, arguments, pleas for the next get. No more hours and hours of homework each week, except for The View and my specials. And then, as the song goes, the days dwindled down to a precious few, and it was time to go. I was hoping that the last interview I would do on 2020 would be with President Bush. In September, after he had won the Republican nomination for re-election, I had put in a request to interview him. I was told he would consider it. Earlier in the summer, however, I had received a whispered phone call from a woman named Mary Kay Letourneau. She had recently been released from a 7-year term in prison for her sexual relationship with an underage student named Vili Falau. Later, they married. I had talked with Mary Kay years earlier before she was sent to prison, and she told me then that I had seemed sympathetic. She now said, over the phone, that she was considering telling all about her experience before and after her prison sentence, and would I be interested in doing the very first interview since her release. I said yes, and I hoped I could do it in August or early September. But Mary Kay couldn't make up her mind if she really did want to talk. Finally, she did, just a week before my last day on the air. I would have to go to Seattle, Washington to do the interview, as she was not allowed to leave the state. The way the timetable worked out, it meant that her interview would air Friday, September 24th, 2004, my announced last day on 2020. While I was weighing this, a call came from President Bush's office. He had agreed to do the interview with me. Were we ready to commit for next week? The President of the United States, or a convicted child molester? The President, the child molester, the President, the child molester. The powers that be chose Mary Kay Letourneau. I rest my case. To be continued. Just for the fun of it, I sat down to write this final chapter on New Year's Day, January 1st, 2007. A lot of things came together for me that weekend that, as it turned out, still hold true. Let me turn back the page. I had just finished a telephone call with Jackie, who was bringing me up to date on New Horizons, her camp in Maine for troubled adolescent girls. The program has been very successful, and I believe that she has saved many a young girl's life. I am so proud of what she has accomplished. I undoubtedly did some things wrong when she was growing up, but I tell myself that I also must have done some things right to have helped produce this very special woman. I love her dearly and admire her enormously. By chance, I had lunch yesterday with some friends, including a nice man I went out with a long time ago, John Hyman. We used to see each other when Jackie was in her terrible teens. He reminded me of how worried I was about her and about myself back then. If I could have only looked ahead and seen her as she is today. The road has long since smoothed out. I took a vacation over the holidays, and part of it was spent with my close friends Annette and Oscar De La Renta. Oscar is, of course, the famed dress designer, but he also owns a great resort in Punta Cana in the Dominican Republic. Annette and Oscar are the kindest hosts. I have gone to their home every Christmas for many years now. At night, the De La Rentas often invite friends from all over the area. One evening, a couple brought their son, who was severely mentally and physically impaired. I was used to avoiding films and plays about such children. Although this boy was far more disabled than my sister, I was afraid it might stir up old, sad memories. But the point of this story is that I was not upset. My strongest emotion was the compassion I felt for the young man and his parents. I was no longer second-guessing what I might have done or not done about my sister. That road has finally smoothed out, too. Because I have so small a family, my friends have become my family. That's why I spend holidays with some of them and, throughout the year, try to see each of them as often as possible. I think a lot of people consider friends to be even closer than relatives. I would list all of my friends' names, but I am bound to leave some out, and that would do more harm than good. I am writing about certain of those friends now, because they were the ones I happened to see over the holidays. After I returned to New York, I had a busy weekend. On December 31st, I had lunch with my friend Lola Finkelstein, who, you may remember, was with me in Israel 25 years ago for Moshe Dayan's funeral. She now has 4 married children, 11 grandchildren, and 2 sets of twin great-grandchildren. She is a very well-read and highly intelligent woman. Her great passion these days is playing bridge. Our lives are so different that you might think we would have little in common, but we have so many memories to share, and we know each other so well. I tell her how rich she is with such a large, loving family. She tells me how rich my life is with such a fascinating career. We are both right. We also know that nobody has everything. We hug each other and say so. Earlier this week, I also had a New Year's lunch date with my oldest pal in terms of years of friendship, Joyce Ashley. She is a fine psychotherapist. We have known each other since childhood and gone through marriages, divorces, and all kinds of experiences together. We tell each other, as we often do, how extremely fortunate we are to have the other in our life. Looking back, which is often what one does during the time of the new year, I realize how many people have been a close part of my life and for so long. My assistant, Monica Caulfield, has been with me now for 27 years. She is my right and left arm. I have watched her grow and blossom and marry Billy Dollinger, such a perfect match. Monica is simply wonderful. She is patient and considerate on the phone, takes old-fashioned shorthand, and has kept my dates and appointments straight for all my different television programs and my private life for over a quarter of a century. I have never seen her ruffled. I trust her judgment in all kinds of situations. I don't know what I would do without Monica, and I hope I never have to find out. I have another assistant named Monique Medina. Monique has only been with me for 4 years, but she is as lovely and calm as Monica. The fact that one of my assistants is named Monica and the other Monique drives people crazy. Someone calls up and says, "Is this Monica?" And the answer is, "No, it is Monique." So the next time they call, they ask, "Is this Monique?" Answer, "No, it's Monica." No wonder they sometimes hang up. While I am talking about the people I live with professionally, practically day in and day out, I must mention once more that beautiful brunette, Lori Klein, who has been doing my makeup now for 14 years. My on-camera face is pretty much like my off-camera face, only for the past few years, when I'm on the air, Lori has given me false eyelashes. They look great, but I can't put them on by myself, so if Lori glues them on in the evening before I go out, I try to sleep with them in place so I look good the next day. This usually doesn't work out. I wake up looking cockeyed with one eyelash on and one off. Anyway, the point of all this is not to discuss eyelashes, but to tell you how special Lori is. She is always peaceful, always supportive. Many chapters ago, I wrote about Bobby Armstrong, my makeup artist during my days on the Today Show, and when I first went to ABC. She was a comfort in those difficult years, just as Lori is today. Then there is Bryant Renfro, whom I have also written about. Bryant has been styling, cutting, and coloring my hair now for 23 years. Sorry that you had to find out I am not a natural blonde. When I travel, I am contractually permitted to take with me one person, supposedly an assistant, but more often than not, I take Bryant. He is not just a great traveling companion, but the producers welcome him because Bryant is also a whiz at dealing with airline reservations and is a super whiz when it comes to computers. In flight, he often calls up on his computer many of the videos I need to see, and I am able to watch a lot of material I might otherwise have missed. For example, in September 2006, on our endless trip to Australia, where, as I've said, I interviewed Terry Irwin, Bryant had on his computer the whole memorial service for her husband that I had not had time to view and needed to see before doing the interview. Bryant also gives me the latest news, which he reads on his BlackBerry. He jokingly says, "I am strong like bull." So let me tell you that he also helps me put my carry-on into the overhead compartment. All that, and he cuts my bangs. Monica, Monique, Lori, Bryant, invaluable as co-workers and friends. Then at home, sweet home, which wouldn't be sweet without my beloved Ikodel Tomlinson, 34 years of running our home with the loveliest smile you have ever seen. Ikodel is an angel on earth and my trusted confidant. I would, however, be remiss if I didn't remind you of another resident in our home. Well, actually, Ikodel says she is really one half dog and one half person. I am talking about Cha-Cha, my honey-colored Havanese. My home is a place of serenity, except for the rare occasions when Cha-Cha feels she must bark. After all these digressions, I returned to New York in time for New Year's and spent a glamorous but cozy New Year's Eve at the home of Sir Howard Stringer, now the chairman and CEO of Sony Corporation, and his wife, Dr. Jennifer Patterson. Sir Howard, before he was knighted by the Queen, you may remember, was the man at CBS who offered me the big contract to leave ABC. Even though I turned him down, we liked each other so much that we became good friends. His wife, Jennifer, is a delight, very smart and very funny. This was the second New Year's I spent with them and other mutual friends, including two wonderful writers, Nora Ephron and her husband, Nick Pileggi. We drank champagne, toasted one another, and watched the fireworks from their terrace. This year they had a new guest, Queen Noor of Jordan, the widow of King Hussein. Queen or not, she had no other plans for New Year's Eve. She arrived looking gorgeous, in a slinky white evening gown, hardly the picture of the grandmother she had recently become. I had done the very first interview with the young American-born queen and her husband when they married back in 1978. I had also done the first television interview with her after the death of her distinguished and long-reigning husband. More firsts to think about, more memories. My long-ago reporting on peace between Israel and Egypt seems like something that happened in another century. Come to think of it, it was. At midnight, Howard and Jennifer turned on the television so we could all watch the ball drop in Times Square. Times Square is on 42nd Street and Broadway. Just 6 blocks away is the street sign that reads, Lou Walters Way. People who pass the sign may be puzzled as to who Lou Walters was and why there would be a street named after him. When I see that sign, as I often do, pictures flash through my mind. All those opening nights watching my father's productions, sitting at his table near the entrance of the club, my father with his squawk box on the table so he can give directions backstage, my mother all dressed up, and my sister so eager to go backstage where she feels most at home. The columnists come up to the table and clasp my father's hand. Great show, Lou, they say. And I am there, serious, shy. On New Year's Eve, as on Thanksgiving, birthdays, any celebration, there we all are. I still dream about my family. Sometimes sweet dreams, sometimes sad. But we were, indeed, a family. And what I am is what they helped me to become. I look up at that sign when I chance to pass it and smile. I retired from 2020, but I did not, as many thought, retire from television. I'm still working every day, what with The View and the specials. Moreover, I have a new venture, radio. I now do a weekly live program on Sirius Satellite Radio with Bill Getty. We take phone calls from listeners, discuss hot topics, argue, agree, and just have a swell time. It is fun to work with Bill, whose opinions are just different enough from mine to make for lively discussions. I don't need to put on makeup or get my hair done for Sirius, and I expect to be doing radio until my dotage. Sirius also is airing almost all the interviews I did for my specials over the past 30 years. Listeners seem to enjoy hearing them as much as they used to enjoy viewing them. I particularly liked doing the special this year that I told you about, called How to Live to be 150. It was cutting-edge science, including the latest in stem cell research, and a drug that now fights aging in mice and may in the future work on humans. Mind-boggling. As part of the special, I interviewed half a dozen on-the-ball men and women who were each 100 years old or older. My favorite was 101-year-old Dorothy, who came with her 94-year-old boyfriend. Dorothy told me that she is happier now than she has ever been. She had been married, she said, for 46 years before her husband died, but it was a bad marriage, and finally, she had found true love. So there you are. It really is never too late. I also enjoyed for the same special, well, enjoyed isn't exactly the right word, speeding at 150 miles an hour with Paul Newman at the wheel of his race car. I held on for dear life as we careened around 2 laps of the track. Later in the day, Paul, who is now 83, came in first in his race, beating guys half his age. I'm not sure he will still be racing if or when he is 100, but let me tell you, even though it embarrasses him, he still has those great blue eyes. I've done several interviews over the past 30 years with Newman, and at the end of this one, we clasped our arms around each other, admitting we were both getting to be ancient, and it wasn't so terrible after all. So now there is the question of when to truly retire. Let me tell you a final story. Last New Year's, before I went out to celebrate, I watched my very dear friend Beverly Sills host a program on public television called Great Performances. Few people have delivered greater performances than Beverly, who was one of the world's most acclaimed operatic sopranos. She was a relatively new friend. I had only known her for about 30 years. After Beverly made the decision to end her operatic career, she went on to become the general director of the New York City Opera, then chair of Lincoln Center, and still later, chair of the Metropolitan Opera. When she left the New York City Opera, her husband Peter gave her a gold ring with an engraved inscription. When I decided to leave 2020, Beverly gave me the ring. She said I should pay attention to what was inscribed. The ring says, I did that already. Sadly, my darling Beverly died of cancer in July 2007. In September, I spoke at the memorial service the Metropolitan Opera held for her. Thousands of people filled the opera house up to the highest tier. To me, the most important person there was Beverly's daughter, Muffy. Muffy was born totally deaf and has never heard her mother sing. But Muffy is an amazing woman, smart and sensitive, with Beverly's sense of humor. She is truly her mother's daughter. We stay in close touch and share our love of her remarkable mother. I miss Beverly every day. Memories, memories. Mine are mostly good. The ghosts have receded, but occasionally they come to the fore. I recently gave a dinner party, and, as is sometimes my custom, at the end of the meal I introduced a question for each guest to answer in turn. The question I posed was, "Looking back at your life, what do you regret the most?" When Sarah Sims Rosenthal, whose husband, Dr. Mitchell Rosenthal, had been so helpful with Jackie, answered, "I regret not having been with my mother when she died." Tears stung my eyes. I, too, still regret not having been with my mother at the end. But no one can undo the past. This is the most important thing. I am probably happier and more at peace than I have ever been. I know I had a fantastic career. I know I traveled everywhere and met almost every important person there was to meet. I achieved more than I could ever have imagined. My colleague Don Hewitt repeatedly tells me that he and I lived through the golden age of television news. Perhaps he is right, but I don't want to spend my days looking back. I do know this, however, in this time of instant internet news, cell phones that take videos, and a profusion of blogs where everyone is a reporter, there will be little chance for any single person to have the kind of career that I've had. If I was, perhaps, a top of the game, I also had the advantage of being ahead of the game. How lucky I was. How lucky. Perhaps I have made it a little easier for some of the women who followed in my footsteps, maybe even for some in other careers. Television is no longer a man's world. Perhaps, too, I helped to change that. If so, I am very grateful. I am blessed 7 times over. And there are even some days when I think I deserve it. But I also think it may possibly be time for me to finally say, I did that already. It is time to stop auditioning. Except for this book. This is Bernadette Dunn. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Audition, a Memoir by Barbara Walters. Published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated. Text copyright 2008 by Barbara Walters. Production copyright 2008, Books on Tape.